Hi, I'm Bill Willard. You're listening to the Fandom Squad podcast.
Hey everyone, this is going to be another episode of the Fandom Squad podcast. My awesome guest this week is Titanic historian Bill Willard. How's it going?
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me, Jeremy.
Thank you. Thank you for coming on. So the first thing I want to ask you, were you just a historian? I know there's a lot of stuff the exploring did you do. Were you part of the team that actually went down in the little submarine thing?
Or? I have not been down in the submersible, but I've been to the wreck site twice as a part of two expeditions, once as an observer and the second time as a participant. I started researching Titanic in the 1970s, mid-70s, so about 74, so it's 49 coming up this summer. And I did so because there was a survivor on Titanic with my same last name. And I thought, that's neat. You know, I just wanted to see if, you know, no one in my family had heard anything about a connection. But I read A Night to Remember by Walter Lord, which is usually the first book that catches everyone's attention and it starts the fire. So over the years, I did more and more reading whenever I could find something. They had a couple of more movies that came out. And then the big discovery in 1985 only, you know, just juiced me up. It really just kicked me into the next level. And I was able to very fortunately combine my career, which I teach physics. I'm a physics instructor at a college, with my passion. And I invented a camera system, an ROV. And it was designed to go down and go inside the small, enclosed, tight spaces on the ship. George Tulloch, who was the man in charge at that time, and I had a three-expedition plan. First time, we were going to test it out. Second time, we were going to make it do a lot of work. Third time, we were really going to take it to task. And then James Cameron's movie came out about that time. While we were at the wreck site, you'll see behind me, the big piece, that's the largest piece of Titanic that was raised. Our team brought that up, and it's on display right now at the Luxor in Vegas.
Oh, sweet. So, yeah, no, there, I know there's a museum in Tennessee that my fiance has told me about. Are you connected with any of that, or some of those pieces or ones that you guys have found on your expeditions?
The two museums, there's one in Pigeon Forge, Tennessee, and one in Branson, Missouri, that are owned by the same family. We have a yearly Titanic conference in Pigeon Forge, and we work with them. They let us come over and tour the museum, and we do a big dinner in their, I guess, their banquet hall. They have a little banquet room that we all meet and have some things there. So they work with us, and we work with them quite nicely. And they have an excellent exhibit in both locations. They really do. They've got some good pieces. Their pieces are not recovered from the ship. Their pieces are more memorabilia, are things that happened at the time. Artifacts are things that were recovered from the ship. So they have more of the memorabilia in that kind of an exhibit. And they're also informational and educational, and they do a great job. And that is it. Every August, we have a conference there. Now, this August, and that's one of the things I hope to promote while I've got a chance, is that we're doing a big conference August 9th, 10th, and 11th at the Luxor. And it's going to be the 25th anniversary of the raising of the big piece. And we're going to have members from the expedition team there. We're going to have a lot of different sessions. And we're hoping to get a third day where we have actors from the movie there. And I've already talked with one and reached out to two others. And we're getting getting the legal things together, the requirements and the agreements. And we hope to have, my goal is if we can have six actors from the movie, that would be wonderful. We're not going to get Jack and Rose, Kate Winslet and Leonardo DiCaprio. Of course, they're just way too big for what we could do, but we're asking a lot of the other characters. This is a special, we will honor you for being a part of this fantastic movie that's out right now.
That is awesome. Yeah, I'm looking for, are you gonna, guys gonna like a live stream that as well, or kind of have where people can watch it as well? Because that sounds really awesome.
We had thought about live streaming it. The problem with live streaming is how many people pirate what you do.
Yes.
And share it inappropriately. You understand that being a podcaster.
Oh,
you
yeah.
You don't mind if you give them permission to share your link to watch your show, but for them to steal all your information and claim it's theirs, we'd have a lot of that kind of stuff going on. And because, you know, we have in the Tennessee conference, for example, we have family members who tell their stories of what's happened in their families. I myself, wow, thanks to this wonderful ancestry.com, about 6 or 7 years, 2018, however many years ago that was, 5 years ago, traced back the Constance Willard on Titanic to Horsmonden, Kent, England, is where her family is from. And I happen to know that my Willard line is from Horsmonden, Kent, England as well. So I found our common ancestor. So I did have a distant cousin on the ship.
That
made
awesome.
It even more cool.
Yeah, I know the historic stuff I've seen, like in the museums, like I know like they give you a card at the beginning, which I thought was really cool. And you see if you lived or died at the end of it, which I thought was really cool.
I got about half a dozen of them sitting around here somewhere. Here's one. There you go.
Oh, that's cool. That's awesome.
I knew I had one. This one was Arthur Ryerson. That was a first class.
Now, I have seen somebody, a video I saw earlier. It's kind of, I guess, because I had, you know, was doing research and stuff about you and stuff. And it just popped up in one of my videos that there was a book that came out in like, it was like in the late 1800s. It was like, I think 4 or 5 years before the actual events of the Titanic happened. And it was talking about a ship called the Titan.
Gordon Robertson wrote a book called Futility. And there were some parallels with Titanic. Like you said, the ship was Titan. It hit an iceberg and it sank. What happened was after Titanic hit the iceberg and sank, Robertson went back and changed his original book so that there were more similarities than were originally there. But Titan, iceberg, sank, size was similar, number of passengers was similar to begin with. And if you get an original version and then look at a, you know, 10 years after Titanic, you'll see that there are some differences. But like you said, the coincidences of the original book was amazing. It just was eerie almost.
Oh, yeah. It's that saying, you know, that, you know, reality is a lot crazier than fiction sometimes. You know, it's
definitely true. Definitely.
You're like, the fact that it's, you know, the sightseeing. I know somebody was like, there's just a theory that I was like, hey, was he just a, he had this vision or something? Was it kind of like the universe is like, hey, this is going to happen. And it just sent it to somebody, which I thought was a cool concept. So for instance, with that, so you reached out, like, I know you've been researching it way before the Cameron film. So did Cameron reach out to you guys, or was it kind of just a side project and then he bring you guys later on?
Cameron had thought about a movie based on the Titanic as early as the recovery, when he was watching the National Geographic film of the discovery and the exploration in 85 and 86. And he worked on his idea. Now, this is secondhand. This is not from him specifically. I read this about him in the movie. And so his idea, how do you get people interested in a sinking ship? And it had to be with a love story. And it did, you know, 4 billion people, $4 billion 25 years ago is a lot of people that went to see that movie. I was teaching in a high school in 97 when it came out, late 97, early 98. And one of my students comes in and she goes, "Coach, how many times have you seen Titanic?" Of course, it was only in the theater at that time. And I said, I've been 7 times. And she says, "We're going again tonight. It's my 28th time. I just love Jack and I cry every time he dies." And I'm going, oh boy, I know exactly what he did. He targeted his love story toward the girls and the younger crowd. But he did something a little bit more than that, that was good for the historians. He partnered with a couple of people from the Titanic Historical Society. One of them is in the movie. A couple of them are in the movie, as a matter of fact. And he wanted to get a lot of the historical information correct. He went to the same carpet company, for example, that made the original Titanic carpet, and asked them to use the old pattern to make his carpet for his sets.
Oh, that is
same
crazy.
Way with the plates and the dishes and the lamps and all the things that he could find. And he even brought on a great Titanic artist and researcher named Ken Marshall. And he asked, is this what it really looked like? And what's different? What do I need to fix here? Because he wanted the background story to be as close as possible to what was real. And so for those of us who are really more historians than I call it Jack and Rose on the Love Boat. You know, that's, I got to call it that. So we go, and even when I went yesterday, yes, I did go back and see the 3D version yesterday. It's probably going to be the last time in my lifetime it may be in the theaters. And so I had to go back at least once more. But I was looking at the detail behind the Jack and behind the Rose and things like that to see just what those rooms look like one more time, because it's not computer generated. It was actual physical sets. Now, he also, Cameron went to the Historical Society and asked if any of the members would care to audition for an extra, you know, a walk by, somebody in the background or something like that. We could submit information. There was no guarantee anybody would be called, but it would have been awesome to do that. There was only one problem. Titanic, the model that he built, that he did his filming on, was smaller than the authentic Titanic. The tallest man on board was John Jacob Astor, 6'3", roughly 6'3 or 6'4", and was played by an actor named Eric Braeden, who is a soap opera star. So Eric Braeden is only about 5'10 or 5'11". So everybody had to be smaller than 5'11", or else you're taller than the tallest man on Titanic. I'm 6'3". At that time, I was 6'3 and a half. I was 6'3", 6'4 when I was playing college football. And so, you know, you shrink as you get older. And so I was not able to audition because I was too tall. I would have to hunker down. And they just said, probably, you'd probably exclude you because you'd look kind of funny if you walk around squatty and stuff. So that was a chance I had that I didn't get to take, but I'm still grateful for what they produced. It was a magnificent film.
Yeah, that's awesome. And I know there's a lot of, like you said, he did his research, because I don't know if a lot of people know that, you know, Jack and Rose, that was just what he created. It wasn't real people, but actually there was real people. Like Kathy Bates's character is actually a real character. And that's what my fiance was telling me, that when there's one part of the museum and then you find that out, that she was actually a real person, that they mixed in some of the real historian people that were there in with, you know, the fake love story of Jack and Rose.
That's right. Margaret Brown, she really wasn't unsinkable Molly Brown until they did a musical about her, until much later. Margaret Tobin Brown is a famous story. It's just incredible, just her story by itself. There are two of her great-granddaughters that are very active in the Titanic community. One of them lives out in Missouri. Is Helen Benziger is her name, and Helen is such a gracious, wonderful lady and has been to our conference. In 2019, we had 9 family members present that had family on Titanic. In Denver, there's the Molly Brown House that you can go and tour, and it was Margaret Brown and her husband's house when they were in Denver. And that one is taken care of and owned by another great-granddaughter named Muffet Brown. And we hope to reach out to Muffet and see if she would be interested in coming to our conference in August. We're going to reach out to Helen as well, because Helen's a very special lady. She really is. Both of them are wonderful to talk to. I'll tell you a great historical story. In the Cameron movie, you see that there's a fuss between Kathy Bates and the sailor that's in charge of her lifeboat. That was Quartermaster Robert Hitchens. Now, Hitchens was the man that was at the ship's wheel when it was ordered to try to steer around the iceberg. And Margaret Brown and Hitchens got into a big argument over going back for other people. So when they had the 2012 100th year anniversary, Muffet Brown went to the British Titanic Society gathering, and there was a great-grandchild of Robert Hitchens. And the two of them closed the door and talked about something. So they're out there, and one of them gets up and is telling about this event. The other one stands up and says, "Now, wait a minute. That's not the way it went." And the two of them got into an argument, and it was set up, and everybody's sitting here going like this, that these two people are here. They are, you know, three generations later, the same two people getting into an argument over the same thing. And finally, both of them started laughing so hard, and they realized that the audience realized, y'all just pranked us. And that was awesome. And the sad part is nobody videotaped that thing. They should have gotten a standing ovation for that, just for even thinking about it. That was great.
That is cool. That had to be a sight to see. Like you said, it was one of the things, like, man, where were the cameras at that time? Now, one thing too, I know there's another one too with the that it, some people say that it is, and some people say that it wasn't. The orchestra guys that you see in the film. And I know that somebody said that was another one that was an actual event that Cameron had done research and found that was one of the things that all the orchestra people, you know, went down with the ship playing their instruments.
They did. Wallace Hartley was the band leader. And there's always been a slight controversy over the last song that was played by the band. A lot of people heard the last song was "Nearer My God to Thee." But one person claimed she heard something else. She heard "Autumn." Now, the two songs are similar, but they're distinct enough so that they don't sound like each other, if that makes sense. They're both slow, and they got beautiful string harmonies and everything like that. And so Cameron had his Hartley play "Near My God to Thee," and Jonathan Evans Jones was honored to be chosen to play Hartley in the movie because that was one of his idols growing up learning the violin. So his opportunity to play his hero was very special to him.
Oh, that is cool. I didn't know that. That is awesome. That's a little cool little nugget. That's awesome.
They have a violin, and the Titanic community, some of them are split on it. Some people say that it is a claim that it was the violin that was on Hartley's body when he passed away, when he died. So that when they found his body a couple of days later, the violin case was strapped to his body, and this was the violin in the violin case. Another group said, well, it's not on the list of items that were recovered. The case was on the list, but there was no violin listed as being a part of it. So some of the community said, yes, it is. Some of the community says, no, it's not. It's all in which one you believe. Whether you can't prove either way. So that does travel around on occasion that it was Wallace Hartley's violin that he had on his body when he was found, when his body was recovered.
Oh, well, which I would think that would, for me, I'll be like, yeah, I'm just going to accept that's it. That's a cooler story that he was, you know, had his instrument that he loved for his life next to his heart and his dying breaths, you know. Absolutely. So for stuff like that, I know it's hard for a lot of times, you know, to, you know, figure out exactly whose was what things. For something like that, I know, like for collectors, I know museums, it's a lot easier to get. So for like, if a private collector, what is something like that? I know people use the term like it's priceless, but what is something like that? Do you know, like if it was on the public market, that would go for something like that?
That particular violin was sold several years ago, and it was auctioned off, and it went for $1.7 million US dollars, about $2 million euros approximately.
Oh, wow.
And it is owned by a private collector, and that collector does not have his name out in the public. So they don't know who owns it. There is a way to get in touch with that person if you want to exhibit it. For example, it's been in Pigeon Forge and in Branson, and they know who to contact the owner to get the approval. And of course, they keep that close to their vest because that's not something that they want to share, is who the owner is. But it's very well taken care of. It's packed very carefully before transit. things like that. Now, actual artifacts on the bottom of the ocean cannot be sold in an auction. They cannot be sold to private collectors. This was one of the court rulings. The man who started the process was named George Tulloch. George was my mentor. I believed in many of the things that George stood for with the company. And the agreement with the court was, number one, that they would recover artifacts and they would preserve them. They would take care of them. They would conserve them. They would put them through the process of conservation. Number two is that they would not sell them. They would keep the collection together because if you bought something from Titanic, it would go back there on your wall with that nice looking guitar and with some yes. of those other awesome places you would put it back. Mine would go over there on that mantle with all yes. my important pictures and things like that. And everybody would do that. They would show them off and the world would never get to see them. So George felt that they need to be kept together and not sold. And the third thing that was agreed to was that we will put them on exhibition so that people of the public can come in and can look at things like the big piece, the D-deck door, the Saul Feld perfume vials that were found in his carry bag, the suitcase contents of the different suitcases they've recovered, things of that nature, and perpetuate this story. And I believe in that. I believe in showing and exhibiting the artifacts. And I've gone in before. And one of the things I like to do is sit and watch people. And I'm not, you know, some weird stalker, but I like to watch people's emotions. You know, if you're at a concert, you'll always see a camera showing the audience because they want to see the emotions and the reactions of the people listening to the music.
Oh yeah, people watching is the whole thing.
Absolutely. And I'll go and I'll sit at something like Big Piece and I'll watch the families come in and they're grown men that are my age. I'm 61. They're just tears are coming down their face because they realize that this is not just a piece of metal on the side of the ship. That may be what it was when it was built, but it represents so much more now. It represents every one of the people that were on board that incredible story, that ship. For that incredible story, it represents 1,496 people that did not make it out of the water that night. Of the 712 that did make it out of the water, it represents each of their stories because all of them told what happened to them during that incredible evening. And it means more than that. I've seen people just sit down and sob. You know, you'll see some people that go, that's cool. Well, let's go eat lunch. You'll get a few of those, but you'll get so many of them that understand that there's history involved, that there were people involved, their heart stories involved. And that's what George wanted to perpetuate is the sharing of these stories. It's been such a great honor for me meeting people like a Frank Goldsmith. Frank is in his upper 80s now, 80, 87, I think. If I'm wrong, Frank, I'm sorry. Frank will correct me. Frank's a great guy. I love Frank. You know, he's almost like a big brother to me. Frank's father was 9-year-old Frankie Goldsmith on the ship. And then his grandmother was Emily Goldsmith. And his grandfather did not survive, Frank John Goldsmith. And to hear Frank start sharing his father's story. This is what Dad told all of us. This is how Dad told it. This is how my grandmother told me. And all the little hidden things that you never hear in the books or everything. His father, for example, had a little cap gun. We all played with cap guns when we were young. Nowadays they don't. It's not woke. So they done away with a lot of the cap guns.
Even from the ones I had in the early 2000s are like a no-no now. And I'm like, it's just a little powder that you pop and it's just a little sound.
It was fun. Yeah. We all played with them. But his father had one and his grandmother told the father, you can't bring that with us. So he sort of did something he wasn't supposed to. They had a carpet rolled up and he pushed his gun inside that carpet.
Oh, wow.
And after Frank spoke and told us that story one time, I said, wouldn't it be incredible if we found that carpet? and we're able to unroll that carpet. His grandmother's sewing machine is in it, wrapped up in it as well. But we also find your grandfather's, or your father's cap gun. And he just got all emotional because it's still there. And, you know, the dad said, Frankie, the little nine-year-old, is that he would run around and they had a group of young boys and they called it the posse. And they would run around and do things and get in trouble and some stuff like that. And I said, I wonder who was in his posse. And nobody knows. Nobody knows until I started reading another account by Rhoda Abbott. And she had two sons. Her sons were Ross Moore Abbott and Eugene. And Ross Moore and Eugene did not survive. But she talked about her room was right next door to the goldsmiths, and her boys would run around and play with him. So those were two members of his posse. And we found that out just a couple of years ago. So there's new things to be learned. We just have to comb the research with a great fine tooth comb.
Oh yeah. And just going back, you know, to the emotion thing, that's one reason I love museums. Like I said, I'm only in my, I'm say late 20s because I just turned 18. Crazy. Not 18, but 28. Oof, I wish I was 18 again. Just turned 28. So I'm like, I'm on that edge of, I'm still in my 20s, but I'm hitting that 30 mark in a couple of years. And I just like these, like that emotion that you feel. Like, I love museums just because it's these, you see these pieces that are just like in time that you know the, yeah, that might be like, we went to a military museum in Savannah and, you know, there's all that military history there. And there was the giant, you know, the cannonballs, and just, I know that's a chunk of metal, but like, I'm like, I just, it's, you know, the history and the lives that impacted and what that ball changed from just in existence.
Absolutely. And off the coast of Savannah, you had one of the most incredible shipwrecks there's ever been recovered. They found the Central America.
Oh, wow. I know there's the pirate store because we went to the, that was an amazing place. If anybody, Savannah, the pirate house, there's the old, you know, the term Shanghai, where they would put them in the little pirates who catch them and get them drunk and put them in the hole and you would become a pirate because they would use you for your labor and they'd Shanghai you to wherever they needed you. If you
didn't work, that's it. They would beat you until you worked.
So seeing that is just, I'm like, they used to have it where you could go down in it, but as of, you know, recent years, they closed it off. And I was like, well, dang, I wish I would have came a little earlier, but just getting to see, you know, they have it where you can go and walk and look down and just seeing, you know, like all the lives and all the history that has been there. And that's why it's one of the most haunted places in the United States. And it's crazy because that's where I proposed to my fiance because we're both into the spooky horror stuff. So I was like, why not the oldest building? Because I'm a history guy and you're into the spooky. So why not the oldest in the haunted place for us to go, hey, let's get married and do this thing.
good choice on that. Good call.
Now, one last thing I wanted to ask you too, is there, you know, anything that, you know, like, I know there's a lot of behind the scenes and fun facts from the movies that were put in there. Is there anything that, you know, a lot of your regular viewers that are not, you know, history buffs or anything that wouldn't know from the little hidden secrets that are in the film that are actually from, you know, the real exhibitions and stuff?
Our first Titanic conference was in 1999, a year after we got back. It was in April. And we had an actor from Cameron's movie attend, and it was Bernard Fox. In Cameron's movie, he played Archibald Gracie. And most people will remember him as Dr. Bombay on Bewitched. I think one of his last movies, he was the pilot Winston in The Mummy that flew him in the plane when the big sandstorm was chasing them. He was the pilot.
Oh, cool.
And so the neat thing about Bernard Fox was that he was also in a 1953 movie, A Night to Remember, the original Titanic movie. So we got him to talk about both movies. And Bernard was telling us all these fantastic stories. He said something, it was like 35 cell phones Cameron would bust. He'd get mad and he'd throw his cell phone. Things of that nature. But the one scene that really catches me is they were filming the scene where Jack and Rose, excuse me, Hockley and Rose are having one of their final confrontations. And she says, "You would rather be with him than me." He says it more gloriously than that. And she ends up spitting on him. You know, she spit like a man type.
Oh my gosh.
And she, you know, coughs up one and nails him. And the story about that was not done on one take. That was actually the 27th take.
Oh,
so
wow.
Billy Zane had to stand there 27 times while she kept nailing him with spit.
Oh my gosh.
And she would get dry mouth. So they'd come out and they'd give her squirt bottle because, you know, didn't want to mess up makeup or anything like that. They wanted the continuity to stay there. So here she would go and, you know, take number whatever, and it would be like blowing, you know, it wasn't a good spit. So we got to try it again. Let's try something else. And they do, and it wasn't any good. And he's just wiping his face off and they're fixing his makeup, and let's try it again. And the scene that actually was number 27, they're saying, what can we do to make the water have more substance to it without her coughing up something really? And
yeah.
I know that's gross. Your readers are sitting there going, ew, and they click the off button. So one of the girls that was one of the production people, she said, "I've got an idea. Give me a couple of minutes." And she ran to her trailer and she came back with a tube of KY jelly. And they got a little bit of that jelly on the tip of her tongue. And she said her line and it splat, you know, and it was perfect. Cut, print, that's it. We finally got this thing done.
Awesome, and, awesome.
You know, he told us of so many different scenes. you know, the people were just floating, you know, the bodies when they were doing some of the floating scenes.
Oh,
that they
wow.
were all out there in costume and they were floating around waiting for the cameras to start. Because all of the sinking parts occurred at night, they had a most unusual filming schedule. Everything that was outdoors, they would start going to makeup around 4 or 5 in the afternoon. And then as it got dark, they'd go out to the set. And then when the sun completely went down is when they'd start their filming. And they would film throughout the night. And as soon as the sun would rise, they'd have to stop. And so then they'd, of course, go back and go to sleep for a while and then get back up. And if they had a scene the next day, they'd go down for costuming and then makeup and everything like that. And then report, they were supposed to report. And he said a lot of it was, you know, like the 27
yes.
spits, okay, took a lot longer than they had planned. He said, so the rest of us would be over there waiting for our scene. And, you know, and they said, we would just be out and they'd have to wake us up and we'd have to, you know, definitely start getting alive again because they were all just zonked out asleep. But he told us so many of those kind of stories. And Cameron did not know he was in A Night to Remember.
Oh,
and
wow.
So they were filming the scene where he's got the two ladies on each arm. And he said something like about A Night to Remember. And Bernard said back to him, he says, "Yes, I know that movie. I was in it." And Cameron stops and he says, Cameron did not know that Bernard Fox had been in A Night to Remember. And Cameron looks around and he says, did any of you know that Bernard was in A Night to Remember? And everybody on the cast is shaking their head, yes. And he's going, wow, I guess I'm the only one that didn't know this. And so he found that out filming that scene where he's got the two ladies under each arm. Come with me, miss. I'll take you forward to the other boats. Like that.
That is awesome. Yeah, that's crazy. Like, I love the behind the scenes, you know, stuff like that. That's why, like I said, that's why I love doing this podcast, to find stuff out like that. You're like, wow, I didn't know that. That's crazy. I love that's why I actually, you know, I wanted to be, you know, an actor, you know, voice acting, regular actor for so long. But then I found doing this podcast and doing my own, creating my own films and content, that I fell in love with the making of stuff, the behind the scenes of things. So now I'm like, I started my own production company because of that. I'm like, okay, I'd rather, you know, be behind the camera than, you know, I'd rather be behind the camera than be, you know, in front of it.
Exactly. I tell them when we're doing, getting ready to do a documentary, I would tell them, look, I got a face made for radio. Okay. Let's, that tells you where I want to be. I'll be off camera making sure everybody else has what they need. And hopefully they are talking about trying to do a documentary about the book that I wrote about raising the big piece. And if they do that, they're going to ask me to be an executive producer, because I don't have to research it. I was there. I knew all of the things.
Yes.
So that does help. And we're going to see if they can, do that. That'll be nice. I'd be honored for them to use the book.
That'd be, that'd be great. So you said, have you written books yourself, like multiple books about the Titanic, or?
One significant book. It was called Our Story, celebrating the 20th anniversary of the 1998 Titanic expedition. It was written in 2018, so 5 years ago, and it came out in August, the 20th anniversary. So we're now celebrating the 25th. A production company in Vancouver, British Columbia, the fellow is a Titanic person and has done several Titanic documentaries, acquired the book and read it. And I, out of the blue, I get a phone call, and they were very interested in talking to me about doing a documentary. The problem that is happening with a lot of networks today is they want to work on shock factor and sensationalism, and they don't want true history. They want conspiracies. Where was the conflict? They want those kind of things because they think that's what people want. And, you know, maybe that's sad, because you were talking a minute ago about how important real history is. If you go and look at the History Channel, they're showing shows about aliens, and they're showing all this stuff. Nobody wants to see or to do history anymore.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's I'm doing some documentaries now with my production company, and that's one thing that one of my goals was, I want to get back to, you know, making documentaries where it's not like who's, let's, you know, the murder mystery, or, you know, like great true crimes are great documentaries, but, you know, the back of the history. Like I'm doing working with an animation company right now, and yes, the documentary is going to be about them and their studio. But we talked about it, and they were inspired by, you know, Walt Disney and Max Fleischer, and, you know, they were inspired by these other animators from history's past. And so we're going to do a mix of, you know, about them, but I'm also going to do a deep dive real history about, you know, the olden animation industry, you know, the way it was and what inspired them. So we're going to do, you know, the real history of even the nitty gritty, the dirty. We're going to add in, because I asked them if they wanted to. I was like, yeah, I want to do that, because this is the issue we're running into right now with our studio. We're going to talk about, you know, the dark history part of it too, with Walt Disney, with copyright. And, you know, and so we're going to do all the good and the bad of the history, and not just the pop catch of, oh, that's a good storyline. But I wanted you to, you know, the real history of what happened and why the animation industry is how it is now, and why this company is developing the way they have to do it in, you know, 2023.
I'll tell you, like, talking about animation, here's a great tidbit you can put in your script. Is I am in Asheville, North Carolina, Western North Carolina, home of the Biltmore House. And we had a cartographer. The city of Asheville, a long time ago, had hired a man to draw maps of the city. And he would draw little cartoon stick characters and things around the sides of his maps. And they eventually fired him over that. And the man's name was Walter Elias Disney. And those are the original Mickey Mouse characters and stick figures that are along the sides of those. And supposedly, I've never gone to ask to see those maps in the official city records, but supposedly they do not have those that they will let anybody, you know, take out or anything like that, that they will show you a copy of one. But Disney's little doodlings around the sides and in the legend and things like that is some of his earliest animation.
Oh, wow. That is crazy. I know there's that's one of the stories I love too, is that, you know, Mickey Mouse was made out of a revenge for the guy. He had another character. It was like a rabbit character. And the company he was working with, like, no, even though you designed that and that's your baby, we're keeping that. And when you leave us, you're not taking it with you. So out of a, you know, a revenge to get back at them, he created Mickey Mouse.
Not surprised. Walt Disney had a vision that was incredible. And, you know, Disney's getting a little too big now. They own Marvel. They own Star Wars. And I have no problem with them acquiring Star Wars, but I did have problems with them changing the canon that had already been built. You know, Star Wars had already had numerous volumes of what had happened in the Star Wars story. And part of their acquisition was, we can change what we want to. And then they killed Han Solo, of course.
Oh, I know. That. So me and my best friend, we're huge Star Wars. That's one of our first loves. And so what we do, what we like is the, you know, like the Mandalorian and Rebels, which is the animated stuff. And a lot of people don't realize the animated stuff is a lot more to the books and the original source material than, you know, the films where they could change everything, which Dave Filoni, who does all the animated stuff, he's over that division. Him and John Favreau are the guys who created Mandalorian. And he's one of us. And he was like, that's fantastic. What I want to do.
Everything Favreau does is wonderful.
Oh, yeah. And he's like, this is what we were fans, and we want to actually bring out, like, you know, with the Kenobi stuff, they brung in some of the elements from the books from the, you know, the early 2000s and some of the comic books from the, you know, the 80s after Revenge, you know, in the 80s and stuff. And so I love that, you know, that story. So me and him are like, we are like, okay, the movies, we like the first one because it was, you know, you have old Han and old Leia. But I'm like, after that, I'm just going to forget that you exist. And I'm just going to watch these sideshows, which is actually closer to it's in the timeline of the original. Like, I think Mandalorian takes place between, I think it's Revenge of the Sith and the, I think it's between Revenge of the Sith and the original movie from 77.
Gotcha. A New Hope.
Yes.
I'm looking forward to the next Andor season. I think Andor was extremely well written, and I enjoyed the Obi-Wan series. There is a big fandom push, and I hope they get a hold of Jon Favreau and get him to do this. If you look at Sebastian Stan and then put a picture of Mark Hamill next to him, Sebastian Stan could take on Luke Skywalker's role up until the last trilogy. He could come out. We want the Chiss series brought in, where they had the Katana fleet and everything, the third trilogy in the books. I would love to see that, where he meets Mara Jade. All sorts of things, you know, that are in there. Would love to see that third trilogy of the books.
And oh, yes.
Sebastian Stan as Mark Hamill.
Oh, yeah. Me and my buddy said that. They're like, I'm like, if they have the technology to take Mark and just make him young with the overlay, they can literally take Sebastian and just do a little bit of tweaking and you're perfect.
He looks just like him right now. You're right. Just a little bit of makeup and it's
a little bit of hair dye, you know, and perfect.
He can do it. And Sebastian Stan's a good actor. So,
oh, yes.
That would do that.
Now, part of that, too, that I wanted to ask you as well with the, you know, now that we're into other fandom stuff, besides, I know your love for Titanic. One thing I always ask my guests.
I'm sorry. We geeked out.
Oh, no, you're good. That's part of the show. Like, I like, you know, I know you, some people like, we have multiple interests. That's why I'm like fandom, because I'm like, I'm into a bunch of different things, as you can tell from my collection. So besides, you know, I know we love, you know, you love Titanic and Star Wars. What are some of the other things that you love? Like, one of my things that always shocks people, I'm like, one of my favorite movies is, you know, Leslie Nielsen's, you know, Forbidden Planet. I love that movie. Robbie, I have to show you, send you a picture of it. I have the actual, like a 12 inch of Robbie the Robot that talks and walks.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, that model came out, I think, in the 60s, early 60s. And if you got an authentic one of those, that's a nice acquisition.
Oh, unfortunately, it's a replica of the 60s model. It's one that came out, I think, like 2017. because I wanted an original
retro toys things that they're coming.
Yes, I wanted an original one, but my fiance would not let me drop $1,000 on a toy.
I understand that. I do several types of research. That is one. One more Titanic, or two more Titanic areas that I'm interested in, is there's a story called the Addergoole 14, Addergoole 14. In Ireland, in County Mayo, one small little Catholic parish, the Addergoole Parish, Lahardone and Ballinar and several of those little towns sent 13 people onto Titanic. That was the largest quantity in such a small area. And of the 14, three survived, and their stories are incredible, how the three survived. So I went over there, stayed with the grandnephew of one of the victims. He was so wonderful to me. His name was Tommy Canavan. Tommy, you know, here, stay here. We'll feed you. We're going to put you up. We're going to show you all these important areas. And I talked to a lot of the family members to learn what happened and the stories behind the scenes. And nobody in America very much understands the Addergoole 14 because it was an Irish story. They didn't have a lot of money to publish it and things like that. So I tell that story. In Halifax in Nova Scotia, they took the bodies that they recovered. After Titanic sank, White Star got three or four ships to go out to the site and to recover the bodies that they could. And they recovered over 350 bodies. Some of them they buried at sea, but a lot of them they brought back to Halifax. Those were identified where people had money to pay for the shipping. Those bodies went back to the U.S. or to Canada, or set course back to England and Ireland and places like that. But those that didn't have any money, they buried them in one of three cemeteries. And there are still 42 people that are unknown there. So I proposed a project before COVID called Project Name Them All, where I have an international team. I have a forensic anthropologist. I have two DNA specialists. I've got the world's greatest historians. One is from Austria. One is from Scandinavia on the team. I've got several from America, but they are well-versed in passenger and crew research. We feel very strongly that if the cemeteries would allow us to go and obtain a small DNA sample from any of those bodies, all of those bodies, all of what's down there still, that we can identify those people, each of them, that we can get a viable DNA sample from. And the only thing we can really give them right now is their name, so that their family can come back and can, you know, place a flower down and touch the headstone and, you know, talk to their family member because it's been so long. The cemeteries are very hesitant about it. They think that the public will not perceive it very well. However, of the 1,100 victims that were not identified, we've got 243 on our side and zero against us. All the family members want to know, is that my family member or not? Is that my relative that's buried there in that unknown grave? We've identified who we think, you know, a list of about 8 or 10 people that each one could be. And those would be our first attempts to identify. But all the family members living in 2022 and 2023 right now have said, I will volunteer to give DNA from my family. All you have to do is ask. And that's called Project Name Them All. Namethemall.com is the website to tell you more about that. If you go to my website, voyagesexploretitanic.com, it will talk about the book. It'll talk about Project Name Them All. It'll actually link you over to the other website. But it talks about this upcoming conference. Another thing is I collect comic books, so I am a deep comic book collector. What else geeky do I do? I'm a historian for the Civil War and World War II. Being in the South, I had quite a few family members that were in different units in the Civil War. And I've gone to most all the battlefields that they fought on and traced their movements. In other words, where did their unit go and what did they participate in? And if you remember the movie Cold Mountain, they depicted the Battle of the Crater, where they dug underneath the southern entrenchments and they set off an explosion. And it was some miners from Pennsylvania that designed that and did that. And one of my great-great-grandfathers was killed in the blast and was buried in that crater. And that's in Virginia. It's right outside of Petersburg. And so that is another one of those horrific pieces of our history. I wish things had not led up to a war. I wish, you know, things had been different for our nation. But it was something that needed to be decided, which power had more authority, the states or the federal government, and that battle decided it right there. And a lot, you know, almost 700,000 young boys, both sides total, lost their lives. And it was such a horrific conflict. But, you know, the Southern boys, you know, believed that this, you know, they didn't like the North telling them what to do. States' rights is what all the people fighting, most of the people fighting fought for, because all, you know, the North fought.
Oh yeah, that's like with the whole situation with, you know, with the reason they're fighting. I know it's a history that we don't like to talk about, but I'm like, it's still one of those things that we need, you know, we need to talk about. I know it was, there's a lot of things that, you know, were done to people and done, you know, to, you know, groups of people that were not right. But we still need to know this history, because, like, I believe that if you don't, it's one of those things, it's that old saying, if you don't know the history, it's going to repeat itself.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And we, if we are a smart people now, we learn from what happened then. And like you said, we do everything within our power to avoid those ugly things, the mean things, and hateful things. And we try to, you know, grow and be one nation again. It's not going to happen in my generation, probably in my lifetime.
Oh,
there's,
yeah,
too many things people want to argue and fuss about. And without saying one side or the other, I wish we could get some people in Washington that would work together to fix the problems that we really do have.
Oh yeah. It's one of those things, like, it's the same way I feel. It's the, you know, let's get together no matter what color you wear. Let's, you know, let's get together and fix this thing.
Well, one side does this, one side does this, and the smart path is right here.
Exactly.
And neither side is going to say, let's meet in the middle, though that may be the best path for our country.
Oh yeah. It's like going to the history thing with that I love so much, you know, being a music nerd. Like, I always tell people, because they're like, oh, Elvis Presley invented rock and roll and, you know, all these other names. And I'm like, no, it wasn't. It was, you know, I always credit to, and people are like, especially here being in Georgia, like, you know, rock and roll was created by, you know, for me, at least from my history that I've looked, rock and roll was created by, you know, Little Richard and Chuck Berry. You know, it was two African-Americans that did blues and brought us rock and roll.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you, he may have been the king of pop or the king of rock. We've got those, but they stand on the shoulders of many giants.
Oh yeah. He stood on the shoulders of people who, yes, now they get, I know they have credit now, but at the time they were, you know, they were just session musicians that, you know, didn't get any credit for creating a lot of the sounds and the music that we know as being a rock fan is quite, you know, the rock sound was created by these guys that, you know, didn't get your credit till some of them were actually already dead.
That's true.
So that's why
rock
I love getting
Hall
the history.
Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is a great place to go if you've never been there.
Oh, that's on one of my bucket lists to go, is to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I want to go there so bad. I've been to we have a good museum here in Georgia, the Music Hall of Fame here in Georgia. That's really good. If you've ever been there, it used to be here in Macon, but they moved it, I want to say about 5 or 6 years ago, near Atlanta. And it's an amazing music museum. They have, like I said, stuff from, you know, Otis Redding and Little Richard. And it's there's a lot of musicians from here in Georgia that I didn't realize, you know, I'm a big 70s rock fan. And I didn't realize that, you know, one of the major bands, you know, the Allman Brothers Band was here from my hometown of Macon, Georgia. You know, I can literally drive 15 minutes to the house that they all lived in when they were writing, you know, the the Ramblin' Man or the Ramblin' Man album, when they were writing that album, that house is like 15 minutes from where I live.
Great history throughout the country.
Really. So one thing too, so where are some of the, for your book and stuff, where are some of the things that people can find you at your websites and stuff?
VoyagesExploreTitanic.com is the website. And the book is available Barnes & Noble and Amazon Books. You have to search for Bill Willard, Our Story, and it goes straight to it.
All righty. That's going to be another episode of the Phantom Squad Podcast. Would you just like to see our outro? We always say, enjoy the madness.
Enjoy the madness.